This is a wonderful week for Colombia, not least of all because in just a few moments we get to listen to Joe Trout. My responsibility this evening is quite simply to introduce to you the Provost of the University, who will then present our Speaker of the Evening. I feel privileged to introduce Dr. Robert Goldberger.
Thank you, Mike. Good evening and welcome to the second university lecture of this academic year, to be given tonight by Joseph Traub, the Edwin Howard Armstrong Professor of Computer Science and Chairman of our Department of Computer Science in the School of Engineering and Applied Science, and Professor of Mathematics in the Faculty of Arts and Sciences. Professor Traub is also director of the New York State Center for Computers and Information Systems. I met Joe Traub soon after I arrived on this campus about 2.5 years ago, and I've come to trust his judgment and value his ideas very highly. I'm afraid I've burdened him somewhat with an awful lot of committees and task forces. But one of his winning characteristics is that he always maintains that he enjoys these things. Joe's first contact with Columbia was in the late 1940s, when he was still a high school student. He came to John Jay Hall to help out at the Intercollegiate Chess Championships. Joe was himself quite an accomplished chess player, first board at Bronx Science and captain of the chess team. But I'm afraid Joe gave it all up at the age of 16 when he realized that girls don't play chess. At least in those prehistoric times, they didn't. His brief acquaintance with Columbia was not renewed until 7 years later, 1954, when he came here as a graduate student in physics. A friend had said to him, "There's something over in IBM's Watson Labs that'll interest you." In those days, the Watson Labs were at 612 West 116th Street. Well, the something his friend had been referring to turned out to be a computer, and for Joe, it was love at first sight. Incredible though it may seem, it turns out that today, February 6, 1985, is exactly the 40th anniversary of the establishment of the Watson Laboratories. We did not plan this university lecture to coincide with the right date. We weren't even aware of it until yesterday. It must have been a computer error. In 1955, there were very few universities where graduate students could work on computers, but Columbia was one of those universities, and Joe Traub was such a student. That early generation of students didn't call themselves computer scientists, but that's what they eventually would be. And Joe really feels the specialness, the great fortune of being in on the creation of computer science as a discipline. He's commented that it's like being alive at the time of Euler in mathematics, or Galileo and Newton in physics. Some people are puzzled by the idea of a science centered around an artifact. Science, whether pure or applied, theoretical or experimental, has traditionally addressed itself to nature. But here we're dealing with a science that centers around a man-made object. What is it about computer science that makes it science? Computer science, the computer scientists tell us, is the study of the phenomena surrounding computers. They mean the machine in its widest sense, programmed and acting upon its programs, which are so complex that the results can't always be predicted. It's not just any old man-made object that has a science flourishing around it. In the 40 or so years of its existence, the computer has penetrated to nearly every discipline and to nearly every corner of the world. It arrives and it transforms. At first slowly, because we humans don't really like doing things any different from the way we always did them and prefer to keep right on. And then, not so slowly, until finally we look back and we can't believe that we ever did it without it for our favorite tasks or most stimulating tasks or most difficult tasks or even our most boring tasks. After all, Gelb's first law of computers goes like this. Computers are unreliable, but humans are even more unreliable. As computer scientists ask their questions about the future of information processes, whether they're human processes or the processes of computers themselves, their questions are raised in the presence of an enormous group of spectators. Not only their fellow scientists, but also business executives, physicians, philosophers, planners, designers, movie makers, government officials, historians, artists, engineers, and so on. A whole host of eager, sometimes impatient users who want computer scientists to get on with it so that all those spectators can have better computing for their own particular purposes. Perhaps a further reason for the unusual interest in what computer science may have to tell us is that information processing is one of the characteristics we are fondest of admiring in ourselves. The idea that this machine might somehow, someday, be artificially intelligent is an intriguing idea. It's been a major intellectual motivation for inquiry into computer science and has contributed many ideas to the science. I count myself as one of those eager spectators who hopes computer scientists will get on with it for my benefit and for the benefit of all of you. I also count myself as an intrigued spectator because I've been fascinated for a long time by the idea of artificial intelligence and its implications for the human species. A machine who thinks, as Pamela McCordick has put it, would be a momentous thing indeed. So if universities are in fact dedicated to the proposition that the intellect is a great gift for the human species, and moreover that knowledge is power, then it's most fitting that artifacts that can amplify the intellect and enhance knowledge are being created, developed, studied, and put to use in a university such as Columbia. So now let's return to pick up Joe Traub where we left him getting his PhD in physics at Columbia. From here he went to Bell Labs, and he spent more than a decade there, during which he made extremely important contributions to his field. In 1971, he was recruited from Bell Labs to Carnegie Mellon University to head its computer science department. He built that rather new department from a faculty of 7 to a faculty of over 50, with a matching explosion in quality. In fact, he made it into what many consider to be the best department in the world. It was certainly among the top 3, together with MIT and Stanford. The excellence of the computer science department at Carnegie Mellon helped other departments there, such as electrical engineering and psychology, to become world-class departments. And in the end, it transformed the entire university. Joe believes that computers will transform universities. By this, he doesn't mean the controller's office and the registrar's office, though a little transformation in that area would be welcome too, Joe. What Joe means is that computers will transform the intellectual heart of the university. He believes that in the future, the comparative excellence of major universities may relate directly to their comparative excellence in the use of computers. He came to Columbia in 1979 as founding chairman of our computer science department. Today, less than 6 years later, that department is considered to be one of the world's leading departments and is already in the group just behind the big 3. And what does Joe do as a computer scientist? He started out doing pioneering work on what's now called computational complexity. If you don't already know what computational complexity is, you'll find out in tonight's lecture. In particular, he initiated research in optimal iteration theory, that is, the theory of optimal methods for solving nonlinear equations. More recently, he and his colleagues have been developing information-based complexity, which he'll also discuss tonight. He showed that many diverse problems could be solved faster than previously thought possible by inventing new algorithms. A few of the algorithms that carry his name are the Brent-Traub algorithm, the Kung-Traub algorithm, the Shaw-Traub algorithm, and the Traub algorithm. To me, all these named algorithms are like disease syndromes that I used to have to memorize in medical school. Osgood-Schlatter's disease, Hashimoto's syndrome. But to people in the relevant discipline, they're nothing of the kind. In fact, they're more like cures than disease, because they allow people to solve problems better or faster than they ever could before. For example, together with a student, Joe created the Jenkins-Traub algorithm, which is the most widely used method for solving polynomial equations. Joe has contributed to many other areas, including the study of algorithms and complexity for parallel computers, computer-based dissemination of technical papers, for the building of high-quality portable software libraries, and a branch of computer science called symbolic mathematics. He's published in a wide variety of topics, usually being one of the first to work in a new field. In all, he's written some 80 papers and authored or edited 7 books. This year, Joe will serve as founding editor of 2 new journals, the Annual Review of Computer Science and the Journal of Complexity, the latter to be co-edited with Henrik Vashniakovsky. He's also been extremely generous with his time for addressing national concerns in his discipline. He's served on many advisory panels, review committees, scientific councils, and the like, for various universities and for federal agencies such as the National Science Foundation. Well, I hope you've gotten some feeling for Joe Traub from all I've been saying. His strong suit is bringing order from disorder, whether it's in building a great department or trying to create a general theory about problems with limited or contaminated information. He's both a strategist and a tactician with an eye for the big issues as well as for the details, always staying a move or two ahead of the game. And in addition to all that, he strives for ultimate experiences, from the best of opera in Vienna to the best of skiing in Alta, Utah, from doing his own Chinese cooking to delivering his own university lecture, Joe Traub.
They've been impressed to me that the university lecture is a fairly significant occasion. Perhaps it would be the major news at Columbia on February 6, 1985. Alas, when I opened my hometown newspaper this morning, I found I had been scooped again. Tonight, I will address 3 great themes. The first is complexity, a fundamental invariant of computer science. The second is information, its power and its limitations. And the third is generality and simplicity, the essence of science. One of the most powerful principles in science is to search for invariants. And from a bounty of examples, I will select just a few. You'll observe there are 4 statues up there on their pedestals, high up in the rotunda. If, by chance, or even by design, one of them should tumble down and strike me, therefore bringing this lecture to an untimely close, it wouldn't matter how the statue got up there in the first place. To wit, whether it was hoisted by a winch and pulley from the floor of the rotunda, carried up the stairs on the backs of 2 strong men, or lowered into place by a giant crane before the dome was completed, none of this would matter. The damage done to me and to the statue. And Ellie Gross once said to me she thought the second one from that side really looked like me. The damage done to me and to that statue would depend only on the distance the statue has fallen. Now, the physicists have abstracted the essential quantity of this event and called it work. Thus, work is an invariant. It's our first invariant of the evening, and it depends only on the height from which an object falls and is independent of how it attained that height. There are lots of examples of invariants in physics. In the physics of Galileo and Newton, experiments performed in uniformly moving coordinate systems are indistinguishable. This implies that although the distance between two events depends on the observer, the time between two events is an invariant. And time survived as an invariant until 1905. Einstein, however, believed that neither the time nor the distance between two events is invariant, and he provided a new invariant which combined distance, time, and the speed of light in a certain way. He introduced also a second invariant which combined energy, momentum, and the speed of light. And in fact, the notion of invariant is so basic to the special theory of relativity that the word relativity is something of a misnomer. The theory is really about what is unchanging. Notions of invariance are also central to quantum mechanics, and indeed the laws of invariance are so significant that physicists can derive the laws of nature, or choose to derive the laws of nature, from them. Let me give you an example from mathematics. Draw a picture on a rubber sheet. Well, mathematics is not very useful, and this is a rather abstract example, but nonetheless, you have a rubber sheet, and you draw a picture on it, and now you stretch the sheet any way you like, just don't tear it. It's clear that areas, the angles between the curves, the length of the curves, all are changed. There's one property, however, that has not changed. If we were to move a pencil along a given curve from a point A to a point C, and if we had to pass over the point B on that curve before distortion, we shall have to pass over point B and going from A to C after the distortion, no matter how elaborate or arbitrary that distortion might be. It is the order of the points that's invariant. There's a name for that field that studies that. It's general topology, which is the study of the properties an object retains under deformation. Now, why are invariants so important? Why am I starting this lecture talking to you about invariants? They are what is intrinsic and unchanging in a mathematical system or in the laws of physics, with peripheral details stripped away. They give us perspective on complicated behavior. For some 25 years, my colleagues and I have been studying an invariant which we believe to be fundamental to computation. This invariant is defined to be the intrinsic difficulty of solving a problem, and it is called the computational complexity of the problem. It's an invariant because the complexity depends only on the problem and is independent of the particular method or algorithm used to solve it. And I'll use the word algorithm from now on. It's the word we use in computer science for a method or procedure for solving a problem. And for brevity, I'll often refer to computational complexity simply as complexity. I'd like to illustrate the concept with a famous example. You're given a set of cities and the distances between them. You are to determine the order in which the cities should be visited so that each city is visited exactly once. The tour is to end in the starting city, and the distance traveled is to be as small as possible. For obvious reasons, this is called the traveling salesman problem. And it is an abstraction of many scheduling and layout problems common in real life. Well, let's say the number of cities is 6. Then the problem could be solved at sight or with a little bit of paper and pencil work. But what if the number of cities is 50? Or it's 100 rather than just 6. Then how long will it take you to find the shortest tour? Many people have puzzled over this for decades. No matter what algorithms they devised for finding the shortest tour, and no matter how clever they were, they discovered that the time required to solve the problem took hundreds of years on the fastest available computers. Now, computers have only been invented for some 40 years, and nobody has computed for hundreds of years. What I mean, of course, is that analysis reveals that if the algorithms were to be implemented, that's how long they would take. Now, if people keep devising algorithms to solve the traveling salesman problem, and if any of these would require centuries to run, there's a natural question. Can there be an algorithm for solving the problem faster? Well, to answer that question, we must know the computational complexity of the traveling salesman problem. On February 6th, 1985, no one on Earth knows. Indeed, we don't even know whether the complexity is a polynomial or exponential function of the number of cities. I should mention that if the complexity is exponential, that means you can never solve it for a large number of cities, and we say the problem is hard or it's intractable. Computer scientists have, however, made a remarkable discovery. There are a lot of problems, some of them extremely important, and they all have the same complexity. What we don't know is whether they are all hard or whether they are all easy. And the traveling salesman problem is one of those problems, and there are thousands of them. The common belief among experts is they are all hard. There can never be an algorithm for solving them fast. But nobody knows. For technical reasons, these problems are called NP-complete. Pioneers in this work have been Stephen Cook of the University of Toronto and Richard Karp, the University of California, Berkeley. Let me now return to general issues regarding complexity. I've said the complexity of a problem is an invariant, independent of the algorithm used to solve it. The complexity may, however, depend on the model of computation. That is, what is permitted and how much it costs. Some complexity results are robust with respect to the model of computation, others are not. Often, we measure the intrinsic difficulty by the time required. Sometimes we are interested in the memory that's required, and there's still other measures that are used. In this lecture, I will always concern myself with time, with the time complexity. So to summarize, computational complexity is the intrinsic difficulty of solving a problem, independent of the algorithm, but it may depend on the model of computation. I mentioned we've been studying computational complexity for some 25 years. Actually, at the beginning, two general questions were asked, which might at first seem different, but which are in fact equivalent. Michael Rabin, who's at Harvard and Hebrew Universities, the Thomas J. Watson Senior Professor at one and the Albert Einstein Professor at the other, not bad, he asked, what is the inherent difficulty of solving a problem? Now, the phrase computational complexity was only introduced in the mid-60s, but you'll recognize that Rabin's question concerns complexity. Shortly after the time that Rabin was asking his question, I was investigating iterative algorithms for solving nonlinear equations. There are lots of algorithms to be found in papers and books, but there were no criteria for choosing the best ones. And indeed, to my astonishment, no one even seemed to be trying to create such a theory. I set myself the task of creating a theory of optimal algorithms for such problems. And I should add parenthetically, it was then that I had the simple idea of focusing on the information used by the algorithm rather than on the algorithms themselves, which greatly simplified the resulting theory. Now, those seem to be very different concerns. Rabin's question on inherent difficulty and my question on optimal algorithms. They're really the same. It is equivalent to ask about the inherent difficulty of solving a problem or to ask how much does the optimal algorithm to solve the problem cost? There's only one question. I've introduced complexity to you as a computational invariant, but it also may be viewed as the natural next step in one of the richest streams of mathematical thought. Starting in the 1890s, David Hilbert concerned himself with certain fundamental questions about mathematical systems. At the 1928 International Mathematics Congress, Hilbert asked three questions. Is mathematics complete? Is mathematics consistent? And finally, is it decidable? The answers to the first two questions were provided by Kurt Gödel. They're not what I want to talk about tonight. But is mathematics decidable? By this, Hilbert meant, given any mathematical assertion, does there always exist, in principle, a finite procedure guaranteed to render a correct decision as to whether that assertion is true? That is the famous Entscheidungsproblem. Hilbert's question was taken up by Alan Turing in a celebrated 1937 paper. To answer Hilbert's question, Turing, in an enormous leap of imagination, invented an abstract mathematical device, the so-called Turing machine. He showed that the answer to Hilbert's question is negative. There exist undecidable assertions. So we have a dichotomy. Assertions can be decidable or not. Let's focus on the decidable systems. If the theorems in a mathematical system are decidable, how hard is it to decide if a given theorem is true? That's, of course, a complexity question. It might be that the theorems are decidable, but that the complexity is so high that the question of deciding whether certain assertions are true is intractable. It would take too long. You could never find out. Arithmetic, the everyday arithmetic that you're all familiar with, is undecidable. That is, there exist arithmetic assertions whose truth or falsity will never be determined. There is, however, a restricted form of arithmetic called Pressburger arithmetic, which is confined to just one operation, addition, on the non-negative integers, and it's decidable. However, Fisher and Rabin showed that the decision problem for theorems in Pressburger arithmetic is super exponentially hard, two orders of exponentiation, in the length of the theorem statement. What a wonderful enrichment this is of Hilbert's question. If a system is decidable, how much must it cost to establish if an assertion is true? And so it seems to me complexity continues a great theme of mathematical thought. In general, determining the complexity of a problem can be very difficult. Typically, one establishes a lower bound by proving that a faster way of performing a task cannot exist, and an upper bound, which is the cost of a particular algorithm. So the actual complexity is caught from below by the lower bound and from above. The deeper question of those is the lower bound, which establishes a limit on the possible. Indeed, John Hopcroft of Cornell University once commented to me that establishing a lower bound, well, that's computational complexity. Establishing an upper bound is mere computational simplicity. And there's some truth to that statement. But upper bounds can be very useful when the upper bound is provided by an algorithm such as the fast Fourier transform introduced in the mid-60s, which is much faster than any previously known algorithm for computing the discrete Fourier transform. Now, I've used complexity to denote computational complexity, but complex and complexity are words with rich connotations and are used in many other ways, both formal and informal. I want to suggest just a few of these now to show you how pervasive the idea of complexity is to 20th century thought. We refer to complex, that is, complicated systems. How do complex systems come into existence? For example, how did life start and evolve from the relatively simple components of a primordial soup? Philip Anderson, Sidney Brenner, Richard Feynman, and John Hopfield are among the scientists studying that question. Recently, Stephen Wolfram at the Institute for Advanced Study has been studying cellular automata. Cellular automata is a mathematical system with just a few components and a few simple rules of how these components interact over time. Wolfram believes that cellular automata serve as one model for understanding how the components of physical or biological systems might interact to generate the complicated systems one observes. And he also believes that notions of undecidability and intractability can lead to insights in theoretical physics. The study of chaotic behavior and strange attractors due to scientists such as Mitchell Feigenbaum and Ralph Abram is another example of how complex behavior can be generated by simple processes. Very simple rules, repeatedly performed, generate very complicated patterns. And since some of these patterns have been found in nature, this suggests that complex natural systems might be generated by economical means. Still another notion of complexity is due to research by Chaitin, Kolmogorov, and Salmanov. In their work, the complexity of something is the length of the shortest program which computes it. Computational complexity studies mathematical limits on computation. Investigation of fundamental physical limitations on the computational process has been initiated by Ralph Landauer at IBM Research. Notions of complexity also appear in writing about the arts. Rudolf Arnheim writes elegantly about visual art, citing what he calls a need for complexity. George David Birkhoff introduced a complexity measure in his work in the early 20th century on the mathematics of aesthetics. Finally, the word complexity is used in everyday speech. Performing certain tasks are viewed as complex. These include controlling the national money supply to achieve certain goals, trying to understand the human mind, managing a large organization such as a city, a corporation, a country, or even the most complex of all, a university. I believe that in the future we will find fruitful connections among these diverse notions of complexity, but for the remainder of this lecture, I'll confine myself to just one instance of complexity, namely computational complexity. Now, I used the traveling salesman example to illustrate the basic ideas of computational complexity. I now want to turn to the second of my themes, information. To illustrate basic ideas about information, I'm going to use the example of human vision. How do you see the world? The late David Marr of MIT and his colleagues have developed a computational model of the human visual system. I'm going to give you a very simplified version of a small portion of that model. I want to point out parenthetically that similar issues arise when we design a vision system for a robot. Imagine you're looking at an automobile. You can see what shape it has because, roughly speaking, your brain has performed a number of processes at various stages upon images it has received and stored. For example, at one stage it has outlined the image, it has outlined the images of the various surfaces of the car by detecting the edges that separate them, such as the edge that separates the image of the windshield from the image of the hood. We can detect this edge because there's a sudden change in the slope of the surface. In the next stage, the human visual system identifies the three-dimensional shapes of the various surfaces, and this stage will serve as our example. How do we infer the shape of the hood? A depth value is a subjective distance to a point on the object as perceived by the viewer. The model assumes a binocularity or other means yield a finite number of depth values. And in general, between any pair of those depth values, the hood could have any shape. However, the visual system uses the assumption, we believe, that the hood is smooth and therefore cannot change too much between depth values. Knowing the finite number of depth values and the smoothness of the surface, the visual system approximately determines the shape of the hood. Now, I want to use that simple example of determining the shape of the hood to introduce some fundamental concepts. The first is information. I do not mean information in the sense of Claude Shannon and information theory, and I'll come back to that later. For present purposes, information is what we know about the problem to be solved. Information is what we know about the problem to be solved. So, in determining the shape of the hood, the information is the finite number of depth values and the assumed smoothness of the surface. Because I may want to regard the surface smoothness as fixed and study the effect of varying the depth values, I often regard the set of depth values as the information. The number of depth values is finite, and many different surfaces may have the same depth values. There are just not enough of them to uniquely determine the surface. That brings us to the second concept. The information is limited or partial. Furthermore, the subjective distance perceived by the viewer is only an estimate of the true distance. Thus, the information is contaminated by error. Because the information is partial and contaminated, we cannot exactly solve the problem of determining the shape of the hood. There must be uncertainty in our answer, and this uncertainty is inherently caused by the available information. Our example has introduced four basic concepts: information, partial information, contaminated information, and uncertainty in the problem solution. It should be clear that partial or contaminated information always leads to inherent uncertainty. Similar problems arise elsewhere. In medical imaging, such as a CAT scan, we approximate the shape of internal organs from certain density measurements. In geophysical exploration, we estimate the location of mineral deposits or oil reservoirs by measurements taken at the Earth's surface. Common to these problems is that we want to determine the shape or the location of an object. There is insufficient information to do this exactly because the information is partial. Furthermore, practically all physical measurements and computer calculations are contaminated by unavoidable errors. For physical measurements, this is due to limits on instrument accuracy or even at the quantum mechanics level, Heisenberg uncertainty. For calculations, finite precision arithmetic causes round-off errors and limits accuracy. Again, if the information is partial or contaminated, we cannot exactly determine the shape or location of the object. To further illustrate the notions of partial and contaminated information, I'll use two examples having nothing to do with shape or location. In weather prediction, Earth stations, planes, ships, and satellites make measurements at various altitudes. Inevitably, these measurements, as all measurements, would be contaminated with errors. Furthermore, since there's only a finite number of measurements, the information is partial, and hence we don't know the worldwide weather at any moment. Who cares? The fact that we don't exactly know the worldwide weather at any moment limits the extent to which we can hope to do long-term prediction. And as a last example, here's a mathematical problem without its physical applications. A very simple problem, the computation of a definite integral. Now, for most integrands, we cannot compute the integral utilizing the fundamental theorem of the calculus, since the antiderivative is not a simple function. We have to approximate the integral numerically. Usually, the integrand is evaluated at a finite number of points, and the information is therefore the value of the integrand at those points. Since an infinite number of possible integrands have the same values, the information is partial. The integral is estimated by combining the integrand values. In addition, there's Randolph error in evaluating the integrand, and so the information is also contaminated. Since with the information we're using, we don't even know the integrand, there must be intrinsic uncertainty in the answer. Now, there's an important difference in this example from the previous ones. The integrand, when we started, was specified exactly as a function, but we couldn't use that information to solve the problem. We had to throw away our complete and exact information and replace it by partial and by contaminated information. Now, those are just examples, but problems with partial and contaminated information arise in many disciplines, in economics, psychology, physics, and chemistry, many branches of engineering, biology, medicine, geophysics, decision theory, many of the mathematical sciences, and various aspects of artificial intelligence. Statistics is a discipline which draws conclusions from partial and stochastic information, and I'm sure still other disciplines occur to you. That brings me to my third theme, the theme of generality and simplicity. One of the central theses of science is that the correct level of generality, that is, of abstraction from the particular, leads to simplicity. Unimportant details are ignored. Progress is made by showing that diverse phenomena can be uniformly explained. A sound general theory exhibits structure that's invisible to someone looking at a particular problem, and it also suggests entirely new questions and approaches. For example, some diseases could be cured before the germ theory of disease transformed medicine, but many more could be cured after that understanding was achieved. Another famous example from the history of science is provided by Newtonian mechanics. Before Newton, any reasonable person believed that the heavens and the earth were different domains, and that apples and planets were very different objects obeying very different laws. And of course, for some characteristics, this is true. If you've tried recently to bite into an apple on a planet, but if the correct variables, which are force, mass, and acceleration, if they're considered, then there are laws which apply equally well to carriages, water wheels, buildings, apples, planets, you name it. The disciplines I listed just a moment ago are as different from each other as apples and planets. And yet, for problems in such seemingly unrelated fields, my colleagues and I believe we've identified the basic variables. One of these basic variables is information. We've also identified a fundamental quantity we call the radius of information, and I'll come back to that later. Following the principle of generality and simplicity, my colleagues and I are developing the new field of information-based complexity. Its goal is to create a general theory about problems with partial or contaminated information, and to apply the results to solving specific problems in a wide diversity of disciplines. A group at Columbia has this work underway, of whom...